This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
So if you have overnight lows that only get in, you know, to around 80, that's exceptionally hot for night, and it makes it so much harder to recover. And I think that's something that's really underappreciated, because there's always so much emphasis on, you know, on the daytime highs.
As the dog days of summer shorten and our vacations wind down, we dig into the Sea Change Radio archives to revisit two climate-related conversations. First, we discuss the issue of a warming planet with Andrea Thompson, a science reporter and associate editor at Scientific American. We look at how people and policymakers are trying to cope with the rising temps and examine how different parts of the globe are being affected. Then we speak to David Messina, the CEO of Ruminate, an Australian-based startup that's hoping to transform the cattle industry. The company's main product is a lab-grown feed additive that's designed to significantly reduce methane emissions in ruminants like cattle and sheep. We discuss the problem that Ruminate is trying to solve and talk about the company's business strategy and hurdles it faces. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Andrea Thompson. She is an associate editor at Scientific American. Andrea, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me.
So looking at the work you've done the last few years at Scientific American, it seems like there's a lot of focus on something that we all are very concerned about, which is extreme heat. Why don't we dive into some of these stories, unpack them for our listeners, and give them a better idea of where we are and where we're headed and what we can do about it.
Absolutely. Yeah, so I think, you know, kind of the the high level headline was that 2023 was the hottest year on record, and by a very large margin. It was about 1.15 degrees Celsius, or about 0.3 degrees Fahrenheit, higher than the previous hottest year, 2016. And, you know, that doesn't sound like a lot, and it's not, you know, maybe day to day, but when you're talking on a global level, averaging, you know, the whole world over a whole year, that is a really huge amount. It stands out very clearly in the records. And, you know, these records, by the one of them is kept by the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, goes back 174 years. So that's a pretty substantial time. And based on what's called paleoclimate records, so using things like tree rings or cores taken from ice sheets or sediments, that can give us some glimpse of what the temperature was like before we have actual written records, there's a good chance this is, you know, the hottest the Earth has been since humans have really been around, so a couple hundred thousand years, which is really remarkable.
And here we are in the midst of winter, and there's headlines, I'm sure we can sniff them out, of record cold temperatures in Norway or Alaska or wherever. But that does not necessarily correlate to the planet not warming. So why don't you, if you can pop some of those myths for our listeners who may have gotten some disinformation about how if it's cold outside, the planet's not actually warming.
Absolutely. So the existence of climate change doesn't mean that winter doesn't happen anymore. It does sort of change the complexion of winter, depending on where you are. So, you know, winter is partly happens because of the Earth's orbit and tilt, and that's not changing with climate change. But we are seeing that winter is the fastest warming season of all the seasons. So when you look out over many, many years and over the whole season, there's a very, very clear warming signal. And the way that, you know, plays out week to week, season to winter, year to year, can be different. You know, you can still have a cold winter or cold snaps during the winter with climate change. And there are even some with in terms of snow, that's actually kind of a weird, complex thing. For example, in the Great Lakes, if you're in a place that sees lake effect snow, you could potentially see more of it for a while, because warming means that those lakes don't really ice over as fast. And so when you do have cold winds coming down from Canada, you have the open water and then you get the lake effect snow. So they can actually see more lake effect snow and later into the season than they typically did in the past, which can seem a little counterintuitive.
But so that precipitation is then a function of the warming.
Yeah, exactly.
So you get a lot of snow that and there's a blizzard, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's colder outside. It's just we feel it more in our face because it's snow.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, places that got snow in the past will still get snow to some extent in the future, depending on where they are and depending on how much we warm. But we are seeing also across the Northern Hemisphere that snow cover has been going down with warming, which is about what you'd expect. You know, anytime you look on a more local level, the data always gets a lot noisier. It's much easier to look over a broad scale. But we also do see that, you know, winter's overall warmer and, you know, we are more likely to have these weird sort of warm spells like just happened across the middle of the country. Chicago and places in Iowa got right around 80 degrees in February, which is pretty wild. And we actually, I'm in Brooklyn, and yesterday was, I think we got up to somewhere in the 60, right around 60, which is pretty unusually high for us for February. You know, it's not something that was impossible in the past, but is much more likely with warming, because you have a baseline of those higher temperatures.
And you mentioned how the Earth's tilt, its axis, affects the difference in temperatures between the Northern and Southern Hemisphere. Obviously, it's the summer, late summer in Southern Hemisphere. Have we seen some anomalous weather patterns that are troubling in, let's say, Australia?
Yeah, so they've definitely had some heat in Australia. They've had drought, they've had wildfires. They've actually had that in parts of South America too. Wildfires have actually been particularly notable in a couple places. Colombia has seen, I think it was about 500 fires in January or more than, which is far more than they would typically see in that month. And part of that, you know, is linked to warmer weather and drier weather. And there have been some what are called attribution studies, so where they kind of specifically look for the fingerprints of climate change in particular events, and have found that climate change is maybe playing a role in the drought that's sort of in the Amazon basin and sort of the wider area around that. And there have also been some wildfires down in Chile that were actually deadly. And there's big concerns over wildfires in the Amazon because it's one of the worst droughts ever recorded there. And it's possible that El Nino, which is happening right now, is also playing some role there. Its effects are especially strong in South America because it is a phenomenon that happens in the eastern tropical Pacific. So that's right off the west coast of South America. But, you know, it's clear that climate change is the bulk of what's causing what we're seeing globally and there.
It's too darn hot. It's too darn hot. I'd like to sup with my baby tonight. Refill the cup with my baby tonight. I'd like to sup with my baby tonight. Refill the cup with my baby tonight. But I ain't up to my baby tonight, 'cause it's too darn hot. It's too darn hot. It's too darn hot. I'd like to cool with my baby.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Andrea Thompson. She's an associate editor at Scientific American. So, Andrea, we were talking about the Southern Hemisphere. Let's turn to the Northern one that has the most land mass, that has the most people. And as a result, we get a lot more news during our summer about extreme heat. This last summer, you wrote about how half the world's population faced extreme heat for at least 30 days in 2023 in the summer. This is not going to change. How are people starting to adapt, and how are policymakers trying to help their populaces survive and thrive in the midst of this new reality?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, and one that varies a lot from place to place. There is a growing movement. I don't know if you would call it a movement, but more places are hiring what are called sort of heat health officers, or maybe you call them heat czars.
The opposite of the heat miser. Sorry.
Yes.
Could not help myself.
Someone who is sort of coordinating and thinking about that very question. And I'm trying to remember exactly some places in the US. I think Miami has one, and maybe Phoenix. Some countries in Europe have employed this strategy too. And then putting in place public policies. Like in New York, we have cooling centers. So on days where the heat is going to be in exceptionally high for us, and you know what is exceptional for us is not going to be the same as for Phoenix. You know, people are there are adapted to a higher level of heat than in New York, and are more likely to have air conditioning. But there are, you know, libraries or other places that are open to the public on particularly hot days so that people can cool down. And so kind of expanding things like that, looking at equitable access to air conditioning is another one. People who are poorer are less likely to be able to afford air conditioning, and that can also particularly become important at night. We tend to talk most about, you know, the, oh, here's the high that was, you know, a high of 120 or whatever that was hit today in Phoenix. And those are important, but possibly more important are the overnight lows. And if those are particularly high, it's a lot harder for human bodies to have the kind of recovery time they need. So if you have overnight lows that only get in, you know, to around 80, that's exceptionally hot for night, and it makes it so much harder to recover. And I think that's something that's really underappreciated, because there's always so much emphasis on, you know, on the daytime highs.
Right. We always hear about these record highs, and we're almost like greedy for these numbers. Like, it hit 136 in Abu Dhabi, but like, try sleeping in Abu Dhabi that night when it was 110. That's not so simple either, especially if your air conditioning is either on the fritz or non-existent.
Yeah, exactly. And so I think that's something that, you know, people are trying to get the message about more. And, you know, what can people do? Like, if you don't have air conditioning, what are some strategies? And a lot of that is staying hydrated, finding shade, you know, looking for places like cooling centers, being aware of what some of the symptoms of heat illness and heat stress are. And that's particularly important when you're talking about people who spend a lot of time outdoors, especially construction workers or people who work in agriculture, where you're really in the sun a lot and you're doing very intensive work. And there is, you know, a growing movement among in some of the worker spaces, so unions or other organizations of labor, to put more worker protections in place, because there currently aren't really rigorous OSHA standards. So they have been working on getting more rigorous standards in place at the federal level for a long time, and it just isn't coming out. A few cities, I can't remember which, but a couple in Texas and Miami have been looking at setting their own standards. Oh, I think it's Miami-Dade County, not Miami, the city. To set their own ordinances for, you know, every so many hours, workers should get a 10-minute water and shade break or something like that. And state governments, particularly in those two states, Florida and Texas, have pushed back on that. They're both Republican-led states, both the legislature and the governors. And for business reasons have said, no, we don't want that because you'll have a patchwork of requirements that's going to be confusing for businesses to follow. But it seems a bit perverse to tell people you can't set safety requirements for people who have to deal with extreme heat.
She's an associate editor at Scientific American, Andrea Thompson. Andrea, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by David Messina. He is the managing director of Ruminate. David, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So explain for our listeners what problem Ruminate is trying to solve. What is your technology and how are you trying to change the world?
We're going after one of the biggest problems in climate at the moment, and that is methane emissions from cattle. It accounts just for that one single issue from 1.2 billion cows, about 4% of total greenhouse gas emissions. We have products that reduce those emissions by a fairly complex process that happens in the stomach or in the rumen of the animal, and we're seeing some really exciting results.
So we've heard a lot about seaweed being the kind of this new silver bullet that can reduce methane emissions through a cow's burps being reduced by this additive. But I've also read that growing this amount of seaweed might not be scalable. So Ruminate is trying to solve that problem by doing it chemically. Is that correct?
Yes, it is. The exact same bioactive that is found in the seaweed, we actually take that product, we manufacture it and we stabilize it in our laboratory, and then we produce a product in a pharmaceutical manufacturing process. So instead of having to grow the organic product or the seaweed, we're actually able to manufacture and stabilize our product, which means, like any factory, you can scale it up very quickly. And the faster you can scale it and the easier it is to scale, the cheaper the product is.
And I realize you're in testing, but what kind of percentage are we talking about as an additive in terms of a cow's daily intake? Is this going to be just a little bit of a sprinkling in there, or is it a significant portion of their diet in terms of what you've seen so far in tests?
To get some concept of it, it is more like a sprinkling. It's a very small amount that's added to as a feed supplement in what the animal eats every day. And we actually have several products available to us. So we have a powdered product, which we're very excited about, and is probably our lead product at the moment. We have an oil-based product, so that can go around feed or in feed. We have a product that we are very excited about that we can deliver in water to the animal, so when it's drinking. So that looks very exciting. And our fourth stream is actually a slow-release tablet that goes into the rumen and can last, 6-plus months. So that's something that may only need to be applied once or twice a year. So these four product streams that we're working on, we're confident one of those will fit into most systems that we're looking at around the world.
I don't know how it would work in other markets, but I imagine with the FDA in the U.S., one of the drawbacks of creating a laboratory product as opposed to just if you wanted to just add seaweed that you get from the ocean is you have to jump through some more regulatory hurdles. Is that correct?
Yes, of course. And look, that is the case in every country. Unfortunately, the unique situation in the US is the product is treated as a veterinary product. And as a result of that, it has to go through the FDA, which is 5 years plus, quite an extensive process. In almost every other jurisdiction in the world, it's treated as a feed additive. So the timing is about half to get that product to market. So we do see a really unfortunate situation in your backyard where we've got this great technology coming through, and other companies have good technology coming through as well in this methane reduction space in ruminants, And we all have to go through quite an extensive FDA process, which is not required in any other country around the world. So it's the obviously we have new products coming through all the time in any industry. Ag is probably a little slower than most, and the volume is probably a little lower. And what we have here is a classic situation where the regulators and the regulation is actually not fit for purpose for these new products coming through. So we do have a bit of work to do in the United States to try and customise and change that some of those regulations so we can get these products into the market, still through a very rigorous process, of course. Other countries, including Europe, have a very well-established pathway to market for feed additives, including ones that reduce methane production in ruminants. We're just not quite seeing, unfortunately, the US at that same stage yet.
So when you talk about the regulatory hurdles, does that include the importation of meat? I know in Japan, they import a lot of Australian beef, or the U.S. imports a lot of New Zealand lamb products. Are these products also going to be under scrutiny for the additives that those countries are putting into their food systems, or is this unique to a cattle owner's jurisdiction in that country? Does it translate into the importation of the food as well, I guess is the question.
Look, inevitably, whatever product you are feeding livestock that then get exported into a whole range of different countries, including those ones you talked about, there is a whole process for the seller in this particular case, or the exporter, to demonstrate that through the life of the animal, obviously it's been treated well. There hasn't been any adverse products fed to the animal or given to the animal at any stage during its life cycle. So our product and others will go through that same process and same level of scrutiny as they all should.
Let's talk about the methane reduction levels from your product. What are you seeing thus far in your tests?
In vitro tests, so these are the ones that we do in the laboratory, we're seeing 95% plus. In animal tests, we're seeing, up to certainly that level. But realistically, in the field, it is going to be lower when you get into a larger scale and more animals and a less controlled environment. But, it is still going to be material. We've seen results in the field up to 85%. We're not expecting to see that on a day-in, day-out basis, when we get into large scale, which is the next stage for us. In early next year, we expected to be doing large-scale farm trials across ranches and farms in Australia, New Zealand. Brazil is probably next. We've got trials starting in the EU next year. We've got trials in the US already, albeit, the timing in the US will be slightly slower for that those reasons I described earlier on. No material reductions. The bioactive is very effective, and because we are actually manufacturing this product, we know exactly how much goes into every gram of product and how much then goes into every animal. So it's very precise dosing, and that means our results are a bit more consistent than what you may see from an organic product. And we're also able, as I mentioned, to deliver it in many different formats, oil or a solid or a slow release product or a water soluble product. So that manufacturing process gives us a lot of advantages and then more consistent results. But they still vary. So you mentioned 10 to 90%, I think. The lower quality feed that the animal is eating, in simple terms, produces more methane. It's working harder. The stomach is working much harder to break the product down. That produces more methane. Very high quality feed, the cows produce less. So the range is we see everywhere, perhaps not quite that broad with our product because they're a little bit more consistent, but there is an enormous range even between animals.
Let's talk about the vast undertaking of trying to distribute this product across, you mentioned Brazil, Australia, New Zealand, but I was surprised to see that by far the largest cattle-owning country in the world is India. I imagine a more fragmented industry, and there's probably a wide range of incomes and socioeconomic levels vary quite widely, I imagine, in that country. So how does Ruminate and its competitors crack a market like India, and how do you hope to be the Johnny Appleseed, so to speak, of feed additives for cattle across the planet?
Well, I can only talk about what the strategies that we're looking at. We've been very fortunate that about 6 months ago, the Breakthrough Energy Group invested in Ruminate alongside Prelude Ventures.
And for our listeners, the Breakthrough Energy Group is Bill Gates's venture group, correct?
Thank you. Yes, it is. And the mandates of both those Tier 1 climate funds is to reduce emissions. So we're looking at trying to get product to market as in an affordable and scalable way as fast as possible. That is the mandate. So what we're looking to do is actually partner with existing infrastructure and existing people and existing companies rather than rebuild a massive animal health company, which will take 3 or 4 times longer than this partnership approach that we're taking. So we're not looking to duplicate infrastructure, and that includes the US, Brazil, India, Europe. We're looking to work with Tier 1 existing partners in each of those regions so we can get product to market as fast as possible with people that farmers trust. The logistics has been resolved many, many years ago. Production capacity, all those things already exist. So when you look through that lens, then our target for 2030 is 100 million cattle. That's our mission, and around the world to be treated with Ruminate product, and we're very focused on making sure that happens. I guess to answer the second part of your question, when you look at regions like India and Africa, you know, the cow is a very important part of the culture. It's a very important part of the family. They're not necessarily domesticated for consumption. They play many, many other, in fact, in some cases, the opposite. So we need to find solutions for those regions. Massive, massive cattle numbers, less ability to pay, clearly. So we think there's opportunities to actually provide another revenue stream into those families. Because carbon credits become available for these products. And if we're smart, we can get the products into these regions and potentially generate another revenue stream through carbon credits.
He's the managing director of Ruminate. That's Rumin8, the number 8, David Messina. David, thanks so much for being my guest on SeaChange Radio.
Thanks very much. It's been my pleasure, and I look forward to speaking to you again shortly.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Stereo Lab and Ella Fitzgerald. To read a transcript of this show, go to seachangeradio.com. Stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast on our site or visit our archives to hear from Doris Kearns Goodwin, Gavin Newsom, Stuart Brand, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.